What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interviewed Michael Gervais, sports psychologist. Mike works with everyone from NFL players to Olympians, NHL, MLB, top-level executives, and performers of all different kinds. In this show, we go into everything mental, everything from mindfulness to brain mapping to gratitude journaling, tricks, strategies, conversations that he has and gives to all of these top level performers. So I know you're going to walk away from this with a ton of new knowledge. Before we get started, if you're interested in keeping up with all of the free content that we're putting out, podcasts, videos, blog articles, free programming, stuff like that, go to brutestrengthtraining.com, sign up for the newsletter. Hope you enjoy the show. What's up, everyone? I'm here with Michael Gervais of the Seattle Seahawks. Am I saying that right, Mike?
It is Michael Gervais.
Gervais. All right, man. Thank you for making time out of your busy schedule for me, man. I could not be more excited about this interview.
Cool. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it as well.
So officially, you are the sports psychologist of the Seahawks. Do you have any other titles with any other organizations? I know you've worked with a million different professional athletes and performers.
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me bring you into the windy, kind of complicated world of licensing in the world of psychology. Is that technically I'm licensed in California as a sports psychologist, and why that's important is because you can only use the word psychologist if you're licensed, and that means that you're doing particular type of work. You're working like a deep, rich level. On the psychological domain of performance. And there's other variations as well. There's some people that have their degrees, advanced degrees in kinesiology, and there's a very different type of work that they're doing, which is not the deep psychological based work, but more like goal setting and mindset training and confidence building and said. Not that the licensed folks don't do that, but there's also a depth they're permitted to go to. And then there's also people in the world of psychology that are doing primarily mindset work, like similar to the kinesiology folks. And I know it's complicated and windy, but the reason I just wanted to just kind of start off on the right vector is that I'm not doing the deep, deep work up at the Seattle Seahawks. And everybody knows that in the organization and otherwise that the work I'm doing there is really working on mindset and paying attention to just the strategies from an overall high-performance standpoint that helps support the team's goals and the team culture. And if there's ever a clinical issue or something that is really rich in nature, the psychological perspective, there's a team of folks that I refer to up there. So it's just a small little vector. Most people wouldn't care about it, but I want to make sure that accuracy is part of this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. And right now, are the Seahawks the only organization that you're working with?
No, there's handfuls.
Okay.
And so like in a couple of weeks, I'm punching down to Rio for the Olympic Games to be able to spend time with U.S. women's indoor and volleyball as well as women's beach. And there's lots of other projects that I'm involved in from both a professional sports standpoint, but much of my time is allocated to a business that Coach B. Carroll and I started up that's taking his intellectual property, my intellectual property, and moving that into CEOs of Fortune 50 companies and their 100 to 300,000 employees. And so that's been an incredible venture and partnership with Coach Carroll that I've really enjoyed.
Wow. Is that this business, is that something that the general population can access, or is it only available to those CEOs?
Yeah. So it's not just the CEOs, actually. It's a little too narrow in scope, but there's lots of business models. And our business model was, instead of going to the masses, we have like just a handful of clients, and those handful of clients purchase our service and product for their 100,000, theoretically their 100,000 employees. And so, no, it's not open on for the general public. We'll get there at some point, but we're going like really deep and long inside of corporations right now.
Wow. So what makes you so good at your job that you've become the sports psychologist and coach of so many of these top level performers?
Oh my God, I don't know how to answer that. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I will tell you this, that I flat out love what I do. And I just really am amazed by what's possible for humans. And there's just such an amazing, we are amazing people. And there's so much that is untapped for us that I've just spent my life efforts trying to sort out, like, how does the mind work to become optimal? And what are the strategies, the principles, the sturdy practices that allow people to pursue their potential, which is kind of a fancy word for like relentlessly get better to figure out what good looks like for an individual. And so I don't know, I just love it. I think it's almost like an insolvable puzzle. I think it's really complicated. Mm-hmm. The mind is really, really complicated, and it's invisible, and it's nothing to just muck around with. Every thought has a consequence, and that consequence either builds or debilitates our ability to be fluid, to be intense, to be exactly in the present moment in the right way, in the right context. And, you know, it's beautiful and it's complicated, and we're still just starting out to understand how the mind works. And I love it. And it's, so I don't know. I don't know if that translates to your question, but, you know, I think that most people, when they say, when I'm not around, they'd say, oh, you know what, Mike just helps me be present and just has helped me figure out the ways that I can reveal and trust myself, reveal the insight and wisdom within myself, and I can trust myself, and I just feel like I have better control of my mind from the work that we do. So I don't know, maybe that's two ways to think about it. I love it, and I think that that's kind of the end game that we're working towards, insight and wisdom and being present more often, even in rugged and hostile moments when it feels like all we want to do is escape and, right. and you know, remove ourselves from that intensity.
That's a perfect answer. So I'm curious, what you're talking about helping others with being more present and stuff like that, what daily practices do you have to keep that yourself?
Well, at first, you know, it's a really good question because it's so much more than just a daily practice. Yes, we do need to train our mind. There's only three things as humans we can train. We can train our body, our craft, and our mind, and that's it. And so that's a wonderful question about how do we train our mind? Like, what are those practices to be present? Because the natural state of our mind is easily distracted. It's sloppy. It's all over the place. It's curious. It is trying to create survival mechanisms rather than optimization strategies. And unless we have an intimate relationship with our mind, we're going to be pulled by that drunk monkey, so to speak. That's an old kind of play on some Eastern thought that the mind is like a drunk monkey. And so the practices really are a process of relentless self-discovery. To work to become, to know who you are, and to be able to stand then, once you know who you are better, and I'll talk about how to do that, then being able to stand with conviction in any moment, then being able to have command of your craft, of your body and your mind, in hostile, in rugged, in quiet, in calm, in intimate, in loving moments, whatever those are for you. And we have each one of those all, you know, during the days. It's not just when the lights turn on and it's competition time. So that's kind of the way I think about the strategy. And then there's nothing more important about the self-discovery process, knowing who you are. Epictetus, one of the great philosophers, said, know who you are and dress accordingly. You know, that's me putting it into kind of a more modern frame.
Right.
But so many of us don't know who we are, so we're trying to be like somebody else. And we're never able to really authentically express ourselves. And once we know who we are, the most powerful part of that process, and that's this self-discovery process, nobody can take it away from us. Nobody can take away who you are. No, the lights, the cameras, the rumors on and the snickering on social, the glare from another person, the competitor that's dominating you in whatever competition. Nobody can take away who you are. So it always begins with the process of figuring out who you are. Then you can apply the mental skills to be able to adjust when it's difficult. And there's more for me to say about this, obviously, but I just want to set that there's a framework first, then mental skills on top of it.
I love that. So, Mike, how can I figure out who I am?
I mean, that is the life journey.
Right.
And, I think there's three ways of doing it. One is being around wise people, and not people that are going to give you advice and answers, but being around people that have experienced wisdom and setting that tribe and community experience for yourself so that you're not just taking from them, but you're adding and contributing to their well-being as well. So that tribal experience of being around wise people is priceless because they ask questions. They challenge you to be the best version of yourselves, because that's what wisdom is really about. It's the journey and the inner experience to reveal what's inside. And so that's the first part. The second part, that's about the community and being part of Switched On Conversations, where the tone is exactly right for you. And that doesn't mean it's comfortable. It's exactly right. Then the second part is journaling. So it doesn't sound sexy and popular, as a process, but it externalizes your thoughts. And if you want to know yourself, you need to understand your thoughts. And so moving those thoughts out of your head onto concrete, a forcing function process to make them concrete on, paper, as concrete as paper is, which is obviously mixed analogy there, but forcing that function to examine your thoughts is really important. And then the third is mindfulness and being able to be present and watch your thoughts and not be attached to your thoughts, but without judgment, just observe and follow and wink and smile and pay attention and notice what comes up and what goes away. And those are the three processes that I think are part of the self-discovery process. Then you wrap that in, doing that in quiet, calm moments, doing that in rugged and hostile moments.
Right.
And the more we push our boundaries, which your community is really good at this, I'm not sure how good they are at the quiet, calm, which is which is necessary. If we're always going to be hard, then where's the soft? And if we're always working on being strong, where's the flexibility? And I'm just using metaphors that I know that physiologically you guys answer really well. But that also goes for the psychological dimension. If we want to accelerate our craft and accelerate, the life journey of being the best person we can possibly become in this very short blip of a time on Earth that we have.
It's funny. You said you talked about you don't know how good this population is with the quiet side of things. I interviewed the now two-time games champion, Katrin David's daughter. And she is one of the only CrossFit athletes that I've heard say anything about a mindfulness practice. And I think it's about to, I think we're kind of in a changing time as far as our athletes go, our top athletes. It's such a new sport. And a lot of these athletes haven't, they've never been professionals before. And so I think we're about to turn the corner into this kind of thing. So it's really, it's a really cool time.
And God, what a dominant competitor she is.
Mm-hmm. I
mean, she is like, it's like one of those athletes, no matter where she is stacked, like you cannot count her out. Like she understands the competitive nature, and competitiveness is not a physical attribute. Competitiveness is a mental attribute. It all is about how you work your mind. And if you want to be a great competitor, you've got to figure yourself out so that you can purposely organize your thoughts in a way that support you to be great. And you can wink and say hello and goodbye to thoughts that are getting in the way or slowing you down. And that, remember, sport's just a way to figure out who you are. That's it, period. There's nothing more to it. Like that's the depth of what sport is. And the origins of sport were to train warriors in times of non-war. And war is the ultimate test. It's like you've got your craft and your mind. And in the ancient times, it was your hands, your head, and your feet. And that's all you had, maybe a weapon. And so it's the most ancient testing of a man and a woman to be able to be grounded and present in the most rugged environment. So let's never lose the origins of what we're doing. And then at the same time, because we're not we're not stricken by that intensity of somebody working to kill us on a day-to-day basis. Let's just frickin' play. Mm-hmm. like it's not that serious. And so being able to have that, you know, that fun play. Now, I say all of this, this is a process that comes from self-discovery, and that's not an excuse for being able to train your mind in more concrete ways, which was the original question that jumped us off on this. I feel like I'm on a little soapbox, but
dude, I love it. This is phenomenal. Yeah. I want to back up for a second. The journaling, is there a process that you recommend, or just throw your thoughts down on paper in whatever way you want?
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's so many different ways to do this.
Sure.
And you can, I would say, one, play. Let your thoughts run. Like, just play and learn. That's a really clear structure, which is very loose and oftentimes and so intimidating to people that they give up after the third day of journaling. You know, it's like, right, I don't know what I'm doing. Well, yeah, that makes sense, because it's, you do anything for three times, four times, hit a heavy bag, you know, try to snatch, you know, whatever it is, like, you're not going to be good at it. You're not going to understand the value in it. But once you spend time with it, it becomes very apparent. Then if you want something more structured and formal, there's a series of questions that anyone in your community that's intelligent and smart would challenge you to answer. Like, the most ancient of questions is, who am I? And if you answer that question, whether it's in a mindfulness practice or a written practice, it's a lifelong question. Every day, who am I? And it's sitting with that question and being authentically real with that question will take you to places that are very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And your community prides themselves on doing the uncomfortable. But sometimes doing the physically hard is really not that uncomfortable. It's just, you know, it's just this temporary inner struggle where lactic acid and brandykinase is coursing through your system. And mm-hmm. That's it, right? That, like, that's the worst of it.
Right.
And we also know that you can play with the central governor as well and manipulate that threshold of intensity. And your community really has demonstrated very well the importance of pushing to the edge mm-hmm. to learn who you are. And once you're on the edge, then you can figure out, because your inner voice is screaming at you. But that's not the right time to figure yourself out. That's the right time to build capacity mm-hmm. to stress your system, both physiologically and psychologically. The right time to figure you out is in moments when you can play and be fluid. And it's at the edge of intensity where you're building capacity to reveal who you are, not figure yourself out.
I want to go a little bit deeper into that. And using Katrin as an example again, there were 3, 4, 5 different moments in the CrossFit Games where when everyone else is slowing down, she picks it up, right? And she finishes faster than she started. And she almost looks, you know, more than human, extraordinary in comparison to her competitors. Is there a way that you can practice that, teach that to athletes, like that final push?
Yeah, there's 3 starts to every event. There's the first whistle, if you will, is when you determine the event starts. That's something that many competitors miss. The second start is when the whistle blows. And that's usually when people are thinking that the real start is. Okay, so that's the second start. And the third start is when you're in deep water. And being able to reset there, I think is a really important process or a strategy for people that are great competitors. Because they're looking for those moments where other people are fragile and fatigued. And they know that that is where they excel, because they've trained their mind through training the capacity building process of their body. And so if you've got a great physical engine and your mind is weak, you'll be average. If you've got an incredible mind and your body is weak, you won't even be average. Like, you need, like, it makes sense that you would train body and craft first, and then in the third evolution, your mind. But that would be something that great competitors now that are contemporaries, they've trained body, mind, and craft all at the same time. And, you know, if I stitch back your last question, which is about the journaling process, to be more concrete, one very, very simple process that we ask all athletes that I work with to do is post-practice, just to answer two simple questions. What went well and what do I want to work on? And that they're very strategically designed questions, because what went well supports the idea of facilitating the mechanics of confidence. And that's a whole deeper, longer conversation. Mm-hmm. And then what do I want to work on sets vision. It sets many little goals, and it sets them in a positive direction, as opposed to what, you know, where did I blow it?
What
right.
do I need what to What went to wrong? Yeah. yeah. I love yeah, that.
Yeah. Or what, even what do I, the question, the subtlety of the question, what do I want to fix, is very different than what do I want to work on. Mm-hmm. This is a choice, you know, and if we lose track of that every day in modern times for the privileged, and I don't mean financially, but the privilege that of those of us who are not in the middle of war, or choosing not to be in that place, like, shit, this is just a life that is wonderful, and it's not that way for everybody. So gratitude is just such a rich part of the process.
That is great. I want to ask one more clarifying or dive into the mindfulness a little bit, and then we'll move on. I've recommended it to all of our competitive athletes. I write about it a lot and everything like that. And I've had a really hard time getting people to stick to it. Some people I have a hard time ever getting them to start it. I've done it for about 8 years off and on, and I know the benefits that it's had on my own life and my own mental health. And so I'm just very convicted of it. Is there a way that I can communicate differently with these athletes that will help them stick to it a little bit better?
I don't know how you're doing it. So it's a tough
Great
question
point.
For me to answer.
Great point. Well, it's usually... I don't really go much into detail. I just describe it as training your mind and allowing yourself a little more space. It's a way to relieve stress, and I don't really go into it much more than that. And I usually forward them to a guided meditation on YouTube or something like Headspace.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that like when we're helping others in whatever capacity, whether it's a loving relationship or a coaching relationship, whatever it is, or friendship, you know, it's like knowing who the person is and appropriately nudging them. Mm-hmm. And we can't ask people to go from pre-contemplation to adoption of new behavior. Like, there's 5 stages of change, according to good science.
Right.
And so just like knowing where somebody is in that process and working to get them just one step more advanced than where they are now. So like having that psychological framework of it's Prohaska's stages of change. It's a wonderful model. And that's how one of the ways that we can accelerate people to actually make changes. And then I think what you're asking about is, you know, there's at least 3 other questions embedded in your question. One is habit formation, one is habit consistency, and then one is a compelling reason why they should start. And so if we start in reverse order, the only compelling reason is that you live it. And that's you. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. If, you know, I don't want to be aggressive in this statement, but because I know the same is the case for me, but when you are living it, mm-hmm. then other people are saying, what's up with him? What does Michael have? How has he become that guy? Like, he's just so fill in the blanks. And then once that's part of the process, they will want to invest. So that's the curiosity piece, is that you're the best advocate for a particular science or a particular practice or a particular psychological framework or a particular philosophy. It's you and the way that you live. And then the second is habit formation. Like, that, there's a good science around that. And just figuring out the right triggers and the right time of the day, and then habit, you know, consistency building is usually requires a inner conviction and or a community. And so, I don't know, there's a lot behind that question. So
no, that's great advice. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
What is your goal setting process with athletes, new athletes?
Not very good. Yeah, the research is pretty good on goal setting, and I'm just not bullish on goals. Mm-hmm. And you know, it just feels so mechanical to me, and I don't feel as I am mechanical, and humans are mechanical. There is value in being really clear about what's important, and there can be a great value of writing that down and externalizing it, you know, to our earlier conversation. So I'm not great at it. And there's better people to ask than me about goal setting.
Fair enough.
Yeah. More, I should say, maybe not better people, but more skilled people in the goal setting process.
Right.
That being said, Michael, I do ask everyone, like, what are you working on? What does success look like? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that you want to get better at? So for me, it's more of a high performance model and shaping a model with the person, and not so much like concrete target goals by 3 months. There are better people more skilled people in that process. Right.
I think I've seen maybe a paraphrase of something you've said a few times to your athletes, where it's something like, if everything goes right at the end of the season, what does that look like for you?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's just working on helping get really crisp on, and the question is not like what you just paraphrased, like if everything goes right, what that really means is like at the end of the season, at the end of the year, at the end of your life, whatever we're talking about, what are we doing? And what does it look like when it's working the way that you would hope? And it's just this idea of getting clear in your mind what the aim is. And where that comes from is that when something really matters to you, to me, to your loved ones, you'll do whatever it takes. You'll do whatever it takes when it really matters. And so for you to know what matters is like step one. And that's just part of a conversation to help me understand, and maybe them to articulate, what matters most. What does that look like? And, you know, grandma will, you know, lift a car. You'll do whatever it takes. I'd step in front of a moving van for my, a moving bus for train, whatever the analogy is for loved ones, like whatever it takes. And I just think that that's an anchoring process to get really clear about what's it look like, but are you willing to put in the work? How much does it matter to you is the most important question.
Do you ever have people come to you talking about having trouble staying motivated?
Great question. I hope you aren't going to... I feel like I'm not giving you necessarily easy answers to digest.
Perfect. It's literally perfect.
And it's like, it's just not easy stuff. And mm-hmm. the answer is... To answer your question, no, the answer is no, because I don't know, like seriously, 100% of people I work with are extremely motivated and they're very clear about what matters to them, and they're invested their life efforts to do that work. Mm-hmm. They also happen to be the top, you know, half of 1% of people, of performers in their craft. So they're already demonstrated a life journey and they're in a space where, they're more artistic than they are mechanical. So, but your question about motivation is really important, which is that there's two basic types of motivation, internal and external. And, you know, what people struggle, it's usually because they're over-indexed on external rewards, such as attention, a way that they are going to look or be perceived, getting a new record, and, you know, having a bigger house, a bigger car, a bigger watch, having more fans on whatever social, getting a trophy. Those are all external rewards, making more money. And it's not that those things are bad or inherently nothing wrong with any of them. But once they are experienced, then what? Then what? Mm-hmm. And then the trap in external motivators are that they're outside of your control. And so it just becomes this kind of undulation, yo-yo, up and down experience. And that's, I think, what's laced in your question is, when people are struggling with motivation, what's really going on there? Are they lazy? No, usually not. It's usually not that. That can certainly be it. Like, it's usually an over-index on external rewards, and they don't really even maybe even know that. And or genetically, there's something that we need to take a look at. And or maybe it's a medical condition. So there's always those three things that we play with. Is it psychological, physiological, or genetic? And you can't, if somebody is low on motivation, how do we know that they just don't have hypothyroid? How do we know that, you know, there's not some sort of dysthymia going on where there's a low-level grade depression? So it's not as simple as just one concrete answer, right? It's like having the ability to have a broad perspective to narrow down what exactly it is that might be at the source for the person.
Right. Assuming it's not genetic or chemical, how do you teach people or talk to them, trying to get them to become more internally motivated or focus on internal motivation?
Okay, so first of all, that's a great question. And really, it is very important, though, to understand because people don't know if it's neurochemical or neuroelectrical, if they have some sort of like low-level grade depression or hypothyroidism. They don't know. Right. So if we just talk about the psychology piece, and really they're only firing on two cylinders, it's like not fair, because now it's like you're mentally not strong. Well, that's not the case. It's actually physiological. Right. So, okay. So I just want to say that out loud. But
to highlight that, are there signs that, coaches and athletes can look for to say, hey, maybe I need to get this checked out?
Enduring patterns of low grade energies, of sadness, of loneliness, that's just depression. Anxiety is the same thing, overactivation, overactive mind that is a chronic worry about what could go wrong. Hard to keep, high cortisol levels are often associated with, and those are cheap markers that you can do quick tests with, cortisol swabs. The high cortisol is often associated with retaining fat, but that's not that important. What's important about high cortisol is that they're markers of extreme stress in the system. And that's an anxious, depressed mind, whatever it might be. So there are some biological markers that you can take a look at that are low cost. C-reactive protein is another marker that is relatively low cost, but invasive. And so those are some quick little markers that people can look at. And there's handfuls of others. But to answer your other question is, and or having a skilled psychologist or mindset, deeply trained person on the mind around, and it's easy to sniff out from a trained professional. That being said, if let's say it is that they have some amotivation or they're demotivated, how do you help them get switched on? I think it's a function of asking questions, and you're not going to convince anybody, but asking questions about what are they aligned for. Like, what are they working towards? And they say, listen, I just want the record, or I want people to look, turn their head when I take off my shirt, or, I just want to have a six pack, or whatever, whatever the thing is that they want that's externally driven. And just asking, like, what's underneath of that? What's that like for you? Mm-hmm. And when that happens and you get lots of people to look at you, like, what happens next? It's just asking those questions, and not in a condescending way, but really in a curious way. Like, what is this going to be like? Because the way that I think about people in communities is that we're agreeing to lock arms to help each other become better. And when we do that, we're going to go through challenges together. And when we go through those challenges, what is it going to look like when you're getting what you say you want now and when you're not getting what you say? And so these are just conversations and questions about, where is this taking us? And eventually what takes place is that people talk about what they really want. This is not rocket science. What they really want is they want to belong. They want to be part. They want to work from, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a simple but wonderful model. Like, they want safety, shelter, they want to belong, they want to love. They want to express that. And where that love conversation gets a little kinky is that they think they need to be loved as opposed to sharing love. They think they need to be doubted on rather than expressing gratitude. And so when we over-index on needing to be filled up from the external world, mm-hmm. we ride that roller coaster of being going up and down with the fickleness of other people's temperament. And sometimes that temperament is really helps us, because it's like, okay, you know, F that dude. You know what? Mm-hmm. He's not giving me respect, and I'm gonna get to the gym and I'm gonna push. That's just temporary. You know, it's like, that's not really a great path of mastery.
Right.
And so asking those questions and then getting down to what people really want out of their life efforts, it usually is internally driven.
That is awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I heard you on some interview, I think it was a mindfulness conference of some sort. And I think you said like one of the best characteristics of these top level performers you work with is that they're not afraid to be vulnerable and try new things. So my mm-hmm. question is, are all of them like that? And if not, how do you teach them to, you know, become more like that, trying new things, being vulnerable, et cetera?
Well, I think that vulnerability and openness are accelerants to growth. And being able to grow at the fastest rate possible is part of the process of becoming the best version of you, the best competitor you can be. So so that's just kind of what is laced underneath of that thought. But to answer your question, I don't know if it's necessary, but vulnerability and openness to explore are part of the self-discovery process. And those that are on the world stage, like the top of you know, half a percenters, are they really do have some insight about themselves and how the world works. Is it necessary? There's nothing necessary. You know, there's as many knuckleheads as mm-hmm. spiritual grounded people. There's as many, you know, off-axis pirates as there are cruise liner ship, you know, captains on the world stage. So there's no just one way to do it. And but I certainly think that openness to change and grow is amazing. And also knowing when and how to hold firm, to hold fast, you know, to stay true to what you understand and know is important. And we've got great models for this. Tiger Woods, best in the world, changes his swing a couple times. That's rad. Mm-hmm. You know, and that requires vulnerability to take a risk to do something new. And if we don't take risks and do new in the appropriate way, then we end up staying stagnant. You know, we end up playing it safe and small, and that's just a great recipe for stagnation. And you know, it's just like every day, what are you getting better at? What are you open to learning? And if you're open to learning, there's likely some vulnerability of not knowing. But vulnerability is a wonderful. It's not. There's nothing wrong with that. It's like being a lifelong learner. That's really cool. Right. You know, like
what's better than that?
Well, being an expert for some people is better,
right. But
that is really problematic when you go out of your domain, and no one really likes being around guys that or gals that know it all. You know, that's just it's not very fun.
Right. Off-axis pirates. I'm going to be using that one. I like that. Oh man. What is brain mapping? Is that something that you can explain over audio or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. There's five brain waves that, there's four that I'll pay attention to in this conversation. Four brain waves, neural, electrical, signal waves. And there's people that are far better at this. So I'm more of an applied practitioner in this space than a deep researcher, but there's alpha brainwaves, beta brainwaves, theta brainwaves, and delta brainwaves. And to oversimplify this, delta, when you're making delta brainwaves, it's when you're in deep sleep, you know, in like a deep recovery, deep sleep mode. And they're just slow brain electrical activities, electrical signals. And then there's theta brainwaves, which are not as slow as delta, not as deep, not as slow, but they're slow. And the psychological or experiential characteristics that are accompanying theta is creativity, as well as a wandering mind, like an ADD type of experience can happen with theta brainwaves, if those are when somebody's predominantly in that rhythm. And then there's beta, which is really fast, and that's like that really deep, switched on, deep moment-to-moment focus. Now, when we have too much beta, that looks like anxiety. And so too much of anything's a problem, right? Too much ketchup's a problem, whatever, you know, whatever the sauce of choice is. And then alpha is this kind of neutral cruise control, more fluid brainwave. And beta is the fastest and delta is the slowest. Okay, so with that kind of conceptual piece in place, it gets much more textured and nuanced that there's particular structures in our brain that kind of do, and I say kind of because brain scientists, it's just an exploding area of trying to figure out what this 3 pounds of silly putty in the skull of our, in our skull really is. But there's particular regions and structures in our brain that likely do particular functions. And the most beautiful part about the brain is that there's zero redundancy. It's complicated. It's beautiful. And we don't really know how it's working. But let's say, for example, the left prefrontal cortex, which is if you're holding like your two or three fingers over your left eyebrow, that's your left prefrontal cortex. You know, there's we know kind of what happens in that area. There's judgment. There's monitoring of self. And things that you'll be familiar with is like the amygdala, you know, that part of our brain that is responsible for fight and flight and all many of the emotional response systems. So anyways, not to get too far away from it, is that what we would look at is particular brain patterns over particular regions of the brain. And we do understand that if we have too much theta, it's probably going to be really hard to focus deeply. If we have too much beta, which is that high focus, we're likely going to have performance anxiousness or general anxiousness in life. So we can, with neurofeedback, you can suppress beta, which is that high focus frequency, and or you can increase the alpha. And when you increase alpha, you get a little moment feedback, moment-to-moment feedback in your ear or visually to let you know that your brain just figured out and your mind just figured out how to produce alpha brainwaves in a particular region. And that's what I just said is freaking complicated, you know. And the scientist in this area, one Leslie Sherlin, is phenomenal at this, and he'd be a great guest for your folks. If you're interested in meeting him, I'm happy to make an introduction.
Definitely.
And so, yeah, so one of the things that we do is we map people's brains to get a picture, a snapshot of what parts of their brain are working really well and what parts of their brain they can get better at. And asterisk right now, your brain is different than your mind, right? The brain is that neuroelectrical, neurochemical, physical structure. The mind is something very, very different. The mind is the guider of thoughts, the curator of thoughts, if you will.
Absolutely.
Okay, so anyways, like some of the elite athletes that want to get better see this as a competitive advantage where they can use a neurofeedback training system to be able to immediately suppress electrical signals that get in their way of them being fluid, of them being smooth, of them being intense, of them being focused, of them being calm. And that is trainable. So it's not just, so calm is not just a psychological, it's not just self-talk. It's not just breathing mechanisms that help us be calm. You can do great self-talk and be a great breather mechanically, but your brain produces too much beta brainwaves and it's like swimming upstream. Unless you're a salmon, that's really tough to do. So, you know, I think that having this combination of mind and brain training is definitely the wave of the future.
That is awesome. Yeah, I'm going to follow up with you on that. I would love to dive into that more with him. And we actually have pretty low listenership from the salmon. So that's great advice.
That's funny. And in some ways, like your community really are all salmon. Like, you guys are doing really difficult stuff and with the advent of the CrossFit Games, CrossFit Games, it's what a fun community. Like seriously, I love what you guys are doing.
But they don't like to be called salmon. I think redfish is PC.
All right. Well, let's just stick with being pirates.
Yeah, like, man.
An off-axis pirate is really a cool way to live life, as long as you're not like just plundering the world, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Moving on. I assume you've worked with a lot of women. In what ways are
whoa,
men...
Whoa. What does that mean? Like, you assume I've worked with women? What does that mean?
That you've worked with... every different athlete, every kind of different professional athlete. nothing other implied. In what ways are men and women different in terms of your work? How you have to speak to them, teach them, communicate with them?
At the top, men and women are different.
You know, and
thank goodness. And, structurally, there's differences, in our frame, and culturally, the way that we're both raised, it's different. Our sandbox experience is very different. So our, breaking traditional roles is something that all people are challenged to do. Embracing traditional roles is something that all people are challenged to do. At the top of the top of the top, people are more similar because they're all frickin' so different. And that the thing that binds people together is that they're really uniquely them, mm-hmm. and they're freaking different, and they're the same as all of us. You know, they have the same number of bones, same number of muscles, same kind of size brain. Most people, the same capacity to harness and control thoughts. So, at the top of competitors, whether that's in business or sports or music. They're all uniquely themselves, which make them all very similar in that aspect. I do not have conversations differently with men and women. I see people as human beings, and I work to understand their unique journey that led them to now. So bracing their individualism, bracing them inside of the culture that they identify most with. And, we all really are ends of one. And if we can amplify and accelerate that to be the best version of that N1, shit, that's really cool.
That's a great answer. Talking about teamwork, how do you teach people to, or teach teams to, say, build trust with one another? Is there anything like better than just spending time together outside of the field, court, whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There are much better people at team building, like team bonding, I should say, than like there's people just that's all they do in this field of sports psychology. So what I pay attention to in this space is when we think of the word trust, we think of trusting another person. I think that's the wrong starting place. The right starting place is working on being able to trust yourself so that you can honestly know that you can go into any environment and adjust. And when you have that level of trust within yourself, you don't need to be dependent on others, but you can eloquently work with others. And so it's like work on yourself to be able to trust yourself before trying to trust others. And it doesn't mean that you're, a solo pirate by yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not what we're talking about. But the starting place is like, do you really trust yourself? Do you trust yourself in emotionally charged moments when there's nothing physical on the line? Mm-hmm. Do you trust yourself in difficult situations that physically? And working on that inner relationship, it sounds so soft, but it's really anything but that. That relationship, that inner dialogue with yourself to be able to trust yourself in uncomfortable and hostile and rugged, both emotionally and physically, moments.
Right, so that you can work with anyone in any situation, right?
Well, so you can be yourself in any situation, and when that happens, you know how to trust. You know how to adjust to any environment. Then you know what? Like, so trusting others is really about like, I trust that you're going to be late. Mm-hmm. I trust that you're going to be on time. It's just knowing who they are, and trusting that most of the time, that when we're awake to what other people's psychological framework and as well as behavioral tendencies are, we can trust that most of the time people are going to fall into that pattern. Mm-hmm. Or let me put it on its head, I can trust that you're really different and I never know what's going to come out of your mouth. So trusting others is like, it's the second thing.
Right.
Not the first.
I love how you said that too. It, trust is knowing them. That's great.
I can trust flat out that two of my family members that I love deeply are not going to be consistent with what time they show up.
Right.
It's just sometimes they'll be on time, sometimes they won't. So if they're going to be involved in like something that is timely, I've got to build that in and either leave on time because I know that they're going to be 20 minutes late. You know, it's like just having the ability to be fluid. You got to know them first. Mm-hmm. And the only way to know someone else really is to know yourself. That's why the self-discovery process is the first part of the process, and the second is then discovering others.
Gotcha. Mm. What do you teach guys and girls to do when self-doubt creeps in?
Is that good? I mean, that when self-doubt's there, it's like, it's cool because you know you're on the edge. You know you're in that kind of place where you're really being challenged because mm-hmm. you're not really sure if you can do it. And I'll tell you what, that's the space. I don't know. I love it. I love it. I love that as soon as that little voice whispers, you know, to myself, like, you really think you can do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, okay, now. Like, and so it's just this playful, like, that's when I know right on the edge. So what? How do I help others? It's like, I love that space. And because it's reminding me that I'm right on the edge. And I love that. I love being right on the edge of capability and capacity. It's where our brain is lit up the most. Our mind is most switched on. Physiologically, our nervous system is most activated. And so just like, do you love that or you don't? And so if you don't mm-hmm. love that, self-doubt is going to be really challenging because it's going to give you all the reasons. Self-doubt is a fancy little phrase for like all the reasons why you might not be able to do something in the future. And, you know, and so it's like this self-preserving mechanism to play it safe.
Mm-hmm.
And we can choose to play it safe. That's a whole different way of going through life that I don't know. I don't feel very good at that. Right. I'm not a teacher of that. So there will be other people that are better at teaching that than me.
Correct me if I'm wrong, too. It's almost like an ignorance or a lack of education. I think a lot of people, when they doubt themselves, when they feel discomfort, they think that means they're doing something wrong and that they shouldn't continue doing that, right? They should always feel comfortable, and doing the right thing means they're going to be always comfortable. So explaining to them that what exactly what you just said, right? Like the fact that you're feeling these things is that you're really pushing and you're following your dreams or whatever that may be. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there's a lot in there. Like one is self-doubt is not a feeling. Self-doubt is a thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that, like they're stitched together, but the self-doubt is a thinking process. And what you just layered on there was that, you know, like really, what is your philosophy about how you're going to do life? Are you just intellectually saying, it's, you know, it sounds cool to be, you know, to live on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I'm close to it or getting close to it, I'm going to like beat myself up and freak myself out. So those two, that dissonance is actually really important to pay attention to. And so, that being said, there's also feelings that come with it, like your stomach, emotions, you know, butterflies or whatever, and emotions that come with it or sweat that comes with it. So being aware of your thoughts, your physical emotions, as well as your physical body sensations, all of that's really important in the process. And the more aware you are, the quicker you can course adjust, the quicker you can embrace the course, the quicker you can, you know, the quicker you can move more closely aligned to who you want to be in this moment to align you to be the best version of yourself in a future moment. So all what we're talking about really is the value of mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then the value of knowing the mechanics of confidence and self-talk and how those two work for you. And that just does take work though. This isn't like, I think that I get really concerned about pop psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even know really what that is, I think, but I hear people just saying things that seem really cool, but missing how textured and nuanced and complicated the mind really is. And so, the greatest accelerant we can do is to really go on a path, a lifelong path, to learn who you are. And that comes from the inner dialogue that you have with yourself. And that self-talk is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, look at great competitors that are undersized. How did that happen? Like, mm-hmm. pick any competitor that's undersized, and they're one of the most dominant competitors in the world. How did that happen? That is completely psychological, mm-hmm. right? Like, and that part is just, I think, the most fun that we can have is figuring out our natural talents and skills and abilities, and then using our mind to amplify and accelerate that growth.
Can you tell me about, can you talk about Felix Baumgartner? Can I ask you about that?
Well, yeah, I will say that it's unbecoming, and he made it very public that he and I spent time, and mm-hmm. we worked together on the Red Bull Stratus project, which is an incredible team experience, like an unbelievable community of people that were so bright and mm-hmm. intelligent and embracing being on the edge. And Felix Baumgartner was the athlete that really changed, in my mind and many people's minds, what's possible for humans. And so, you know, I say all that to say that he's been very public about our work, but I feel like it's unbecoming for me to talk about one person in particular, just because of the nature of
sure.
my respect for the legal and ethical space that I hold for people. But there are things that are public that I can talk about.
Right.
So I, not knowing your question, that's like a preamble, I guess.
Sure, sure. I totally understand that. So a little background for anyone that hasn't heard of this. Felix jumped from some kind of craft that from 128,000 feet, which I think is a little over 24 miles. Mm-hmm. And what was public is that there was a significant amount of fear associated with even just putting on his jumpsuit. And it was also public that Michael helped him get over that. So I'm just wondering how much you can talk about that. Like, how did you help him overcome that fear?
Well, it was, he's incredible. And he really amplifies what a hero's journey is, you know, and not that we want to be heroes necessarily, but the hero's journey is about, you know, the strong man stumbling and the strong man figuring out how to keep going. And I don't mean to be gender specific there, but so he was so talented at his craft, and he ran straight to the edge of his capacity, like I hope that many of us can figure out to do in our own lives. And he didn't play it safe. He played it square down the middle of knowing how to trust himself and to trust others inside of his craft of being able to jump from outer space, basically, or the edge of space. Mm-hmm. And it was he was working on the relationship with trust and inner dialogue and self-confidence and all that stuff about, like, how do I keep my mind from, you know, taking over when I'm in a rugged environment? And he's just a beautiful example of we're not just physical beings. We're not just craft specialists. You know, there's the mental and the spiritual side of being a human. And so he was the strong man that raised his hand up that said, I want to work on all parts of being great at my craft. And so I know I'm dancing around it.
No, it's fine. Like,
yeah, that's the essence of it.
Such an amazing thing that that entire organization did. It's so cool. So
Yeah. Well, and so that's like somebody walking their talk and talking mm-hmm. their walk. You know, that's it.
Right. All right, man. That is all of the questions that I have. This is I just know this is going to be fascinating to people, so I can't thank you enough. Where can people learn more about you, keep up with you, all of that stuff?
Okay, I would love for people to learn about themselves, right? And I would love to start there. And yes, I would love for people to connect to some of the fun stuff that I'm grateful and fortunate enough to be able to do. But if we just start with, you know, one minute of breathing and master the inhale and master the exhale, that's it. And do 1 minute. And if that's too much, start with 30 seconds. And if you can do 30 seconds, though, you can do a minute. And when your mind wanders, which it will, come back to the present moment. Like, just come back to this breath. And if you can do 1 minute, you know you can do 2 minutes. If you can do two, you know you can do 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. And when your mind wanders, which it will, just come back. And that's one of the accelerants to self-discovery. So I say that because I'd love for people to start there. And then the second is, find me on social. I love this Finding Mastery podcast that I fired up and I'm building. So it's at findingmastery.net is the website that hosts our podcast. You can also find it on iTunes. And it is conversations with people who are on the path of mastery. We're just very similar to what you and I are doing about decoding the path of mastery. And on Twitter, at Michael Gervais, and that's Gervais. We also have a Facebook community up for Finding Mastery called Finding Mastery. It's facebook.com/community. And there's Finding Mastery Instagram. What else? If you're running a corporation, you go take a look at winforever.com. It's the partnership with Coach Carol that I are doing. And I don't know if you're on the West Coast and love surfing. Maybe I'll see you out in the ocean.
Nice, perfect. I'm gonna take you up on that.
Yeah, anytime.
Guys, we're gonna put all of those links in the show notes, and you can find that at brutestrengthtraining.com/podcast. Mike, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
All right, brother. Appreciate being part of your community. Thanks so much. Best success to all your listeners, and best success. Congratulations to what you've been able to contribute to the field. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you, man. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.